Chief Justice Stitt, may it please the court, I have some handouts that I'd ask permission for the marshal to hand you.
Very well.
Thank you. Forgot that last time. I want to do that again. Your Honors, this is an admitted error case, and the only question I think that we have is whether the error was prejudicial. I think it takes a lot for a trial court to say that it made a mistake, but I think it takes even more for it to say it's prejudicial. In this case, Judge Atwell was not able to get there. And at the heart of this case is a causation issue. Judge Atwell and the majority in the Court of Appeals, the Western District, concluded that because the filler neck had been severed, that the tank location was not all that relevant to the argument that was prohibited by the trial court. And I think that is a misunderstanding of the evidence in the case and of the theory that the plaintiff tried to put forward. And so I would say to you that Ford defended the case, as I read it, on about three grounds. There are more minor ones, but the first, that this was a very big truck that hit this car, this patrol car. They say 1.6 or 8 million pounds of energy coming down the road. The evidence is that 1.1 million of that energy went on. This thing hit the back and the side. It was not a full rear collision like you would expect. And the proof that this impact, though severe, was not of the kind that the briefs lead you to believe about, is that both of the people in the car would have walked away. Autopsies revealed that Trooper Newton had no broken bones, and Mr. Nolte had no broken bones and no whiplash. And so this, while a severe impact, was not the kind of impact that would cause you to think there's no way that this car could have survived the impact. The second thing is that the filler neck was severed. But that's more about where the car was hit. But you also have to remember that the filler neck is attached to the gas tank. And the gas tank was also hit, collapsed, spun, and the filler neck burst out, shooting the gas into the passenger compartment. And the sparks ignited the fire immediately. And so the filler neck, while it was severed, was not the whole cause of the accident. It was the tank location, which was plaintiff's theory. And the third thing that we have to talk about, I think, is that Ford designated before the trial and then put in evidence of post-shield accidents. And the shields were Ford's way of saying, look, if there was a defect in this car, we fixed it with this shield. And I think as you read the arguments, you'll see that once the closing argument took place, that Mr. Emerson was told, you're not going to be able to argue the post-shield accidents. Mr. Feeney then took the word puncture and turned it into leakage and broadened what the shields were designed to do.
So if I understand correctly, it's not Ford's position that Ford says it wasn't saying the shield would protect against this against the severing of the filler neck, and therefore all these cases really aren't relevant, and it's really a distraction from the key issue, and that the exclusion and lack of permission to talk about those post shield cases was not really prejudicial because it didn't really have to do with the cause of the accident here.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's exactly Ford's position, and I hope you'll subtract some time from Judge Covington. But but having said that, we get to put our theory of the case on, too, and that is that the location of the tank was what caused this accident. And our expert testified that if the tank had not been behind the axle, but if it had been above the axle or in front of the axle, that this spinning action that drove the tank to collapse and then drive the filler neck out and shoot the gas into the compartment where the passengers were would not have occurred. And we get to argue that. Now, Ford, very cleverly, I would say, began to talk about its shields. And the shields were designed, I believe, and I think by the way they argued it, to say, guess what? If there was a defect, the shields themselves remedied the defect. We don't need to have moved the tank because the shields took care of all of that. And so we lost our ability because of the trial judge's ruling to argue our theory of the case. Now, it's been argued in Ford's brief that, if you'll put that third one up, please, And this is on the other one. This is on page 8 of the little handout. That all Judge Atwell did was say, and this the Court of Appeals said the same thing, that all Judge Atwell did was say you can't argue the post-Newton accidents. But here's what Judge Atwell actually said. You can't argue post-Shield accidents. Now, if you take away the post-Shield accidents, there is nothing left for the jury to consider about whether or not the defect still existed. Now, how did that evidence get in? That was a chart that was put in by Mr. Feeney, consistent with the designations that of the deposition of Sue Schiske. And you'll see, and this is on page 1 of the little book that I've given you, I believe, that there are 11 accidents that happen after the shield is put in. And when Mr. Emerson tried to argue those 11 accidents to show notice that Ford knew that there was that this shield was not working, there was an objection by Ford, a statement that the evidence had been withdrawn.
And you're not saying the post-Newton incidents, the 6 of them, would have been noticed, but that they came in for all purposes because the other side introduced them?
They were not introduced as OSIs. They were effectively admissions of Ford, but they were not, so therefore the limitation instruction did not apply. But even if it did, they were still in the case, and the jury could consider them because they were never withdrawn. There was no objection, and evidence that's in is in for any purpose unless it's specifically limited, and it wasn't. But it couldn't have been put in for notice because it was after the fact, obviously. But once they're in, they're in. So Mr. Emerson, taking advantage of this, as any trial lawyer would, began to argue them. Ford objects. The objection is ultimately sustained, and the trial court says to the jury, you must disregard the previous argument, which dealt with all of the post-shield accidents. So what are we left with? Well, we can't argue that the shield didn't remedy the defect, that Ford didn't know that the shield didn't remedy the defect. And then when the argument is made by Ford in its closing, Mr. Emerson gets up and says, we think they've opened the door. And the judge then says, well, no, they didn't open the door. And not only that, you're not to argue any of these post-shield accidents. And so that's what we were left. Now,
if I understand correctly, you're saying in part that the trial court misunderstood your theory of the case and thought the theory was about the filler neck and its location, and you're saying, no, it was about the location of the tank?
Your Honor, I think that says it nicely, that the filler, I mean, if you read the trial court's order, you're going to discover, he says, this is a causation issue, it goes to the filler neck. But the filler neck has no gasoline in it. You can sever filler necks all day long and not have a fire. It's only when the place where the gasoline is gets compromised that you have the fire. And as I said, yes, the filler neck was severed, but also, and this is what Wallingford testified to, our theory, that tank was hit, crushed, twisted, the filler neck pops out, the anti-check valve fails, the gas comes squirting out, and there's an instant fire that people cannot get out of the car and burn to death one and terribly burn the other and has to be dragged out by some passersby. And so Judge Atwell, by focusing on the filler neck, completely discounted the Wallingford testimony about the tank location. And I believe it should be abundantly clear that whether or not the jury believes it in the end, we have an opportunity to argue our theory of the case.
Whose burden is it to show prejudice or lack of prejudice?
Well,
not being able to.
You know, we argue that if you cause the prejudice, you have the burden of showing that it was not prejudicial based on Toon versus Synergy, which is a damage case that this court decided a number of years ago. But if we bear the burden of showing the prejudice, I think we meet that standard as well. Because how do you know what a jury is going to do? There are cases that suggest that, particularly as to closing argument, that you don't know how the jury is going to be able to react to evidence, particularly when it's not fit into a theory. And one of the things that we were lost the opportunity to do was to fit this into our theory. that this tank had to be moved, that these shields were a Band-Aid, and that if the tank's not moved, this happens, and if the tank is moved, it doesn't. And so we think there's prejudice, just frankly, just as a matter of fundamental fairness. This is the only place that lawyers really get to get up and say, here's what everything means. Every side gets a chance to do it. And the puzzle is just laying out there in lots of little pieces. But when we get a chance to get up, we get to put those pieces together in the picture that we want. Now, the other side jumbles them up and puts them into another picture. But if all the jury gets to see is the one picture and not the complete picture from the other side, that seems to me to be definitionally prejudice.
Counselor, are you suggesting that we ought to have a broader standard of a presumed prejudice based upon the Toon case? Or are you just saying in this case there's enough evidence of prejudice that a new trial should be ordered?
Well, Your Honor, of course I would like a broader standard, but I don't think you have to get there. Obviously, the three judges at the Court of Appeals who were on the majority side didn't think Toon applied, and Judge Holliger and Judge Spenden on the other side said we don't even have to get to that because this is clearly prejudice. But we think closing argument is one of the most important things that happens in a trial. You can't argue at the front end. All you trial judges say, no, stop that. You can only say about what the evidence is going to be. And then when the evidence comes on, that's all there is. This is the only chance that you can put the picture together. And if you can't put it together, we don't know whether the jury likes the picture or not.
Does the nature of this evidence, being that it's similar incident evidence and this is a product liability case, should that carry any extra weight with the court as it relates to the analysis of prejudice?
Well, first of all, I would respectfully disagree that the stuff that Chiskey put in was OSI evidence. Ford read it in, they designated it before.
Right.
But if it is, I think it has to be factored in for whether it's notice or proof of defect. And here, Judge Covington's brief is exactly right. I may have spoken a bit broadly, but it was only in for notice. I see my time has expired, and I'm grateful.
Judge. That's instruction 3 at the top, Judge Robertson, and at the bottom, the line of Chiskey testimony that's in controversy. May it please the court. I'd like to try to put it in the context initially by asking each of you please to picture yourselves as if you were Judge Atwell. You're the trial court in this case. And picture yourselves at the instruction conference before this case was submitted to the jury. You're going through the instructions. And this goes to two questions. For what purpose was the evidence in the case? And how material or important was the evidence? You go through the instructions and you get to instruction number 3, which is this instruction, which says, as Judge Robertson has just acknowledged, that this evidence is in for notice only. And number 4, which follows that, which goes to Mr. Ridenour, Ford's expert on liability, same kind of instruction. Would you not think that if this evidence were in the case and were so important as to touch upon a material issue and liability, would you not think that you would not say something to the trial court about the fact that this evidence was in the case for any purpose? Now, I'm not sure whether Judge Robertson has just conceded that, but it sounded as if perhaps he has conceded it. If it's in only for notice, then it cannot be argued for defect. And it would seem...
Is it true that this evidence came in from the defendant, though?
This evidence came in from Ford, and I'd like to touch upon that.
They didn't limit the evidence in any particular way when they offered it, did they?
No, Judge Fisher. They, as Mr. Feeney would say, he should have
ask that that be withdrawn. Judge Robertson has called that an admission, and I respectfully disagree with that. It's no more an admission than all other OSI evidence. All OSI evidence came from Ford through discovery requests. Just as in Peters versus General Motors, all OSI evidence comes from GM. So to me, that's an entire distinction without a difference. And for that evidence to be used to talk about defect at all requires a much higher standard than for it to be used to show notice.
But in their argument as to the post-Newton accidents, mm-hmm. that the trial court had ruled they were not sufficiently similar to be relevant and therefore should not be admissible, but by admitting them without saying they were limited to notice, that waived that objection, or in effect that ruling, and the jury could then look at them and consider whether or not they were relevant. And under Ford's theory, they were not, because they involved different kinds of causes of the accident.
Post-Newton, your question just mm-hmm. goes to that right now. Is that
right.
correct? Post-Newton was originally excluded because it doesn't go to notice.
Insufficiently similar.
It's after
right.
the... No. Because it doesn't...
The court limited it to notice because I presume the court rejected the argument that they were sufficiently similar that they should come in for all purposes prior to trial.
All of the evidence was that, Your
okay.
Honor. That wasn't post-Newton, pre-Newton. That was all in for notice. No
okay.
difference whatsoever. There was no distinction. The only reason that there's a distinction in the case is that the post-Newton, once... were excluded, they're not relevant to notice because they happened after the accident.
But if I'm understanding opposing counsel's argument, it's that, in fact, these incidents were also relevant beyond notice to the issue of defect.
That's
because the defect was a broader defect of where's the location of the tank, not what was the particular causal pattern for the tank rupturing,
right.
and that issue was waived by not being... when it came in for all purposes, arguably. And you obviously feel that that was not done, so could you address that specifically?
Yes, that's what I'm looking forward to addressing. They say it's in for all purposes. The dissent said it was in for all purposes. That's totally disregarding, first of all, instruction number 3. Mm-hmm. And as I pointed out earlier, that went right through the case. It was read before Mr. Wallingford. It applies to all other witnesses. It was read before Mr. Ridenour. It went to the instruction conference, and it went to the jury. And nobody ever asked that it be withdrawn.
I was just going to ask, was there any objection to instruction number 3?
No.
On the basis that it took out, it wrongfully limited the use of this evidence.
That's my point,
no
Judge
objection
Price.
To the instruction.
It was offered by the plaintiffs at the pretrial conference, and it went right through the case without a peep.
Excuse me, Judge Covington.
Yes, sir.
If at the pretrial conference, though, there was no idea exactly what evidence was going to be admitted in this case, correct? And as I understand it, the trial judge had granted a motion in limine, so the plaintiff's lawyers surely couldn't have expected that the defendants would offer evidence that they had asked to be withdrawn.
No, they wouldn't have, Your Honor. This is all about the standard for other similar incident, and everybody understood that it's much lower for notice than it is for defect. And the plaintiffs obviously understood they didn't have the ability to lay a foundation sufficient to use this for defect, or you can be sure they would have done it with respect to the necessary similarity of other accidents. And that never, ever came into the case. So we go to number 3, combined with the need to lay a foundation under Peters and all the cases before it for defect, the similarity, the necessary similarity was not there. And
counsel, didn't plaintiff actually propose instruction number 3?
They did, Your Honor. And even if you don't like the argument that I'm making with respect to instruction 3 and the necessary relationship to having to lay a foundation to ratchet it up to the point that this evidence could be used for defect, even if you don't like that, there's still no prejudice because, for a number of reasons, I don't agree quite with the representation of the of what the cases were. The plaintiff basically argued the tank's in the wrong location. Ford, in response, said nothing to do with the tank would have changed the outcome of this accident, in which a 13,000-pound vehicle slammed at the speed of 65 miles per hour into the left rear quadrant of this vehicle and severed the pipe. Nothing would have changed the outcome of that accident. That, in essence, is the Ford defense. And the shields were but a punitive damage defense. NHTSA had investigated this accident and found that despite looking into for 2 years' worth that this is a safe vehicle, this very same police interceptor, I mean not the very same vehicle, but the same model. And Ford contended, even though we knew this, we continued to try to improve and make an already safe vehicle even more safe. One of the things we did was increase the speed of crash testing to 75 miles an hour, and we did these shields. They shield the component parts. They shield the component parts of the axle to keep them from puncturing the tank. And that went to the punitive damage defense. There was a serious punitive claim in here. It went to the jury. So that's what Ford used this to argue. Ford never once said, contrary to what the plaintiffs say without any cite to the record, never once said that they had fixed anything with these shields other than the component parts that they were meant to shield. They testified, in fact, that leaks and fires would continue. We have cites to the record. Mr. Reidmeier testified, Mr. Kupke testified. Leaks and fires will continue. That wasn't even...
Why wasn't it relevant, though, for them to argue in closing that the fact that leaks and fires did continue showed that they should have moved the tank?
If they wanted to argue that, Your Honor, if they thought it was so relevant and so important, they had 46 incidents with which to argue that. Five were shield, because despite the focus for the first time in this court in the reply brief on the 11th, they conceded, the plaintiffs conceded at the post-trial hearing that they knew that they could argue the 46.
So tell me about the other, what are the 46? What are the they had other incidents
OSIs,
they could argue?
And of those, four were pre-Newton and one was Newton. So they conceded that they, with Judge Atwell, conversation with him, that they knew they could have argued yes. But to answer your question, if it's so material, they could have argued that. And they could have argued the testimony of Kupke and Reidenauer that leaks and fires were continued. Therefore, you should move the
tank. Didn't the judge tell them they could not?
No, they just said that he couldn't mention the... Well, Judge Robertson pointed out on the reply brief for the first time the 11. Before that, it was the post. It was... They knew.
What was left for them to argue? I'm trying to get to assuming...
They could have argued other similar incidents dating back from the 70s. Which included five with shields. They could have used that plus the testimony, which is what they said they wanted to argue. Leaks and fires continued, which was Ford's testimony. Leaks and fires will continue. We can't make a perfectly safe car.
Judge Covington, may I interrupt?
Yes.
Wasn't it argued at the closing on behalf of Ford that every one of those leakage modes were addressed by the upgrade kit? Didn't that leave the impression, at least with the jury, that this design defect as proposed by the plaintiffs were in fact addressed, corrected? Judge Atwell, of course, recognizing that he may have made a mistake by limiting their closing argument, even described it that it would have been fair retaliation to talk about the post-upgrade kit accidents and fires.
Judge Dowd, first of all, the leakage modes that were talked about in the closing argument were those to which the shields, that's what was argued. We fixed that. Plaintiffs said, well, that's a Band-Aid. This is all in the context of punitive damages. The argument, the context in which I think I mentioned earlier and we set out fully in our briefs. So what fair retaliation would there be there? when the retaliation that they say they want to argue was that they say we argued that we'd fixed, Ford had fixed all the defects. They say that without a citation to the record. And Ford never argued it. Why would Ford argue it when, in fact, Ford always said there will always be leaks and fires in these severe accident circumstances? Judge Stitt, did I fully answer your question on the... They had an opportunity to argue that. You have all these things, so why don't you move the tank? They didn't even make that argument.
And the argument of Ford was not that, well, because we have the shield, now we don't have to worry about tanks. Okay.
No, and I don't see any record site. It's not there. I would basically, I guess, beseech you to read closing argument. This is a 4,200-page transcript. The closing arguments consume about 400 pages. I have to tell you that when I got to it's a four-week trial. I got to the end of the transcript. I got to the end of the closing argument, reading the transcript. I reread the closing argument. And my reaction is, and I don't mean any disrespect, but how did this molehill become transformed into this mountain? This is one line of testimony to which nobody seriously objected. Again, I take you back, just please put yourself at the instruction conference to show the significance or insignificance of this for all purposes. All purposes. How did this happen? Well, Mr. Feeney has said that if only he had thought to stand up at that one time and asked to have that withdrawn, we wouldn't be here. And I would submit certainly that if you're any contemplation of sending this back for a retrial, that line certainly won't be in the case. But the point is, where on earth is the prejudice? I completely fail to see it. And I would like to tell you that I think that the Court of Appeals opinion is just perfectly fine, but for the one little place with which we disagree, and when the Court of Appeals assumed that the evidence was in the case for any purpose. I'm still contended that that's not the case for the reasons that I have suggested. Instruction number 3 kept it in for notice only, and there was never an attempt, let alone a success. There is never a foundation laid to raise this evidence to the level necessary for coming in for defect, because this accident is entirely different.
Did you say you just had one reference? I thought in your brief you said there were 3 references of
there are, Judge. The plaintiffs have focused on this. The first reference was during opening statement. There were a whole series of power slides going through, and there was a reference in that, though Mr. Feeney never talked about it, but it had been left. These came in from a trial in Illinois earlier and had been used there. So that was number one. Number two was that state statement that's in controversy. And the third was a question from plaintiffs to Mr. Kupke, pressing on him about the 11 to which Ms. Shishke had testified, and he didn't confirm. He didn't know, but that was the third, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I would invite your attention to the chart that's on page 1, which I had not put up. But Ford, even in its own chart, calls this accident a puncture accident. It's part of a list of puncture accidents. And I think that's important because of what Mr. Feeney went ahead to argue. Now, this is the critical chart, I believe. And it's at number 5 of your booklet. And it talks about this, the evidence groups. What happens is that we are no longer allowed to draw the necessary distinction between pre- and post-shield accidents, so that the jury will understand that the defect, Ford knew that the defect still existed despite the fact that the shield's in place.
What about Judge Covington's argument that there were lots of pre-shield accidents and Ford never claimed that all incidents involving tanks would end because of the shield, just that that shielded certain kinds of accidents which they could protect against?
Well, Your Honor, you know, I don't know what juries hear, but here's the language. Every one of those leakage modes was addressed by the upgrade kit. Now, that's the chart that talks about the leakage modes. The Newton one clearly wasn't. That's what Mr. Feeney says. Every one of the leakage modes. Kupka and Ridenour don't even acknowledge what Sischke, who is a vice president, a corporate officer, and when she speaks for the corporation. When she says there's 11, they say we don't know anything about them. And so this is, Judge Covington said, this is a molehill. Well, it's not a molehill. It's a molehill if you're Ford. But from the jury standpoint, when the lawyer's standing there putting the picture together, using the words every leakage mode, and we've not been allowed to talk about the shield that supposedly fixed every leakage mode, and we've got a dead trooper and a burned up man that had the shield on their car, the jury can't draw the distinction that it needs to about whether the defects still exist. And our evidence, which they don't talk about, is that the tank got hit right because where it was. The tank needed to be moved. And the tank got hit. The tank got crushed. The tank got spun. The gas got shot into the compartment. And the people burned. And if the tank had been somewhere else, this doesn't happen. That's what our expert says. Jury doesn't have to believe it, but we get to say it.
Counsel, what do you think about instruction number 3 and whether that would impact your ability to argue anything other than simply notice and whether that made a difference?
Well, I think the notice is important from the standpoint that Ford realizes that the shields are not working. It's not proof of the defect, but the shields aren't working. That's what notice goes
so
in
you don't,
for.
You don't have any problem that did that instruction properly limited you to argue notice
well,
only from that?
Judge Price, the limiting instruction merely announced what the motion in limine did, and it did it before Sischke made these admissions, and they were in, and we believe, for any purpose
yeah,
after
but,
that.
Yeah, but the instruction was submitted after she made the admissions. I mean, that was submitted at the instruction conference, right?
Well, but it was read to the jury before Wallingford testified early in the trial.
But why didn't that serve as a limitation on the purposes for which the evidence came in, since it was announced ahead of time that it was only for notice?
Because it was talking about Wallingford and some other witnesses.
And not this witness.
And not this
right.
one. But even so, do we not get to argue our theory? They don't like our theory. We happen to like it a lot.
Well, aren't you limited by the instruction to what you can argue?
Yes, and all Mr. Emerson wanted to argue is that Ford knew that these 11 things had happened and yet kept sending these cars out without moving the tank.
So you'll accept the arguments just for notice.
Sure.
But you weren't even able to argue notice.
Exactly. And the judge said, if you look up there, he said, you're not going to argue these post-shield things. That's all of them, not just I'm out of time.
Okay, I think there was one more question.
Well,
but then
the judge even said that after defense counsel took advantage of his ruling, correct?
Again,
you tried to mention that in light of that argument, there would be another basis for commenting on that evidence, correct?
That's right. He also prohibited Mr. Davis from making his argument. So, and their admissions, we believe, anyway. So, thank you all for your time. Sorry about my voice.
thank both of you for a well-argued case. The case is submitted.